Good morning. Welcome to Focus, our morning talk show. My name is David Inge. Glad to have you with us. We're also very happy to have back on the program once again, Kevin Waspy. He's a lecturer of finance in the Department of Finance in the College of Business at the University of Illinois. And every once in a while, he's here to talk with us about personal finance. This is a show that we have been doing for a long time on Friday as a regular feature because we knew that people would always have investing and money management questions. David Sinnoh is often the guest. And occasionally, we also like to see Kevin. He's got a little different spin on things, a different set of opinions, but the idea is the same. And certainly, we can talk about macroeconomic issues if you want, but really, the idea of the program is you have some specific question about your own financial situation, and you're trying to decide what to do. Well, here, this can be one piece of research that you can do. Call in, discuss it with Kevin, and he'll give you his thoughts, and then you can take that and put that together with all the rest of your information and use that to make your decision. So whatever your situation is, whatever point of life you're in, whatever you're thinking about, you can give us a call. 333-9455. We do also have a toll-free line that is good anywhere that you can hear us, and that is 800-222-9455. So again, 333-9455 for Champaign-Urbana, toll-free 800-222-9455. And if you want to send an email, you can do that too. That's will-talk, willtalk@illinois.edu. Welcome back.
Thank you, David. It's good to see you.
So what's on your mind?
Too much for the radio, but perhaps not enough to keep our listeners satisfied.
All right. Well, I don't know if there's anything in particular you had in mind that you would like to talk about to start us off.
Well, I think that's probably a good way to begin. We've seen a lot of signs of recovery in the U.S. economy. I think people are becoming a little bit more optimistic. Some of the reports that have been coming out over the past 6 weeks, maybe even 2 months, have shown that there is light at the end of the tunnel, and it may not be an oncoming train. So I would say on balance, people's spirits appear to be picking up. The business activity appears to be better than it was, and we're all hoping that circumstances in Europe and the rest of the economies of the world don't offer us any big surprises.
Yeah, okay. Well, here's something I thought I would ask you about. I don't know how you could respond to this question, and I just came across a recent article noting the fact that there had been a decrease in credit card debt. Now, 11%. Maybe that's not very significant. Some people might say, well, any decrease is good because I think a lot of people argued that Americans and families were carrying too much debt. So if you can reduce debt, a good thing. So the question is there some sort of rule of thumb that people, as they look at their own finances, that they can say this much debt is okay, but this much debt is a problem?
I'd love to be able to say there is a rule of thumb. We could start on that theme with something along the lines of a mortgage lender. A mortgage lender talking with a potential borrower will look at things like debt service ratios. So income to debt service. Debt service, as it goes with a mortgage, obviously, is not only paying the interest on the mortgage, but obviously over time, repaying the principal borrowed. So debt service ratios vary. Part of that variability is based on the stability of a person's income. Those types of things kind of keep me from wanting to use numbers as rules of thumb, because I think if there's one thing that we should have learned over the past 3, 4, 5 years now, we really need to think about the security of our income, and that means the security of our jobs. I mentioned earlier that there are signs, early signs, that the economy might be recovering, that things are improving. But one of those things that shows very little sign of improvement, obviously, is the employment picture. Mm-hmm. Again, any amount of debt over, an amount of income becomes problematic when income is no longer there. So it's not a funny thing. But again, I think our economy is beginning to learn that debt is something that needs to be treated with more caution and respect.
Yeah. Well, what do you think that is the problem? Simply that it's been that credit has been just too available, been too easy to get, and so and easy to use. It's certainly easy to whip out that plastic card and use it, and people just aren't thinking about the fact that that's real money we're talking about, and at some point that you're going to have to pay it back.
Well, exactly. Convenience is a wonderful thing. Like most things we find in life, cost and benefit are usually linked. So along with the benefit of that convenience, there is a cost. And if it boils down to a not understanding the implications of going into debt when a person uses a credit card, that's a serious potential problem. One of those things, mentioning consumer credit, the monthly series that come out on the variety of economic reports are generally pretty volatile. But one of the things that I've not been real comfortable with over the past couple of months in seeing signs of recovery elsewhere is, again, as you've mentioned, the pickup in consumer credit, whether it's a credit card balance, auto loans, or whatever. Part of the acceleration of activity in the economy might appear to be financed by people using more debt after the past 2 to 3 years of them trying to cut back on debt. And obviously, we can build a growing and stronger, more sustainable economy on solid income than we can on borrowed money.
Well, questions, comments are welcome here. We're at your disposal if you have questions about your own financial situation and you have some decision you need to make, you're not quite sure what to do. You can give us a call. Kevin will give you the benefit of his thoughts, 333-9455. We do also have a toll-free line. That one's good anywhere that you can hear us, so the call's on us. And that's 800-222-9455. And then we do also have that email. You want to send us something that way, will-talk@illinois.edu. Here, in fact, is an email from someone who writes this. If you take money out of an established IRA, is the tax load a set flat rate assessment, or is it also a graduated scale like the income tax on your personal salary?
That's a great question. Unless certain very limited options are elected, and again, they're very limited, so now we're getting into complicated matters that a CPA would really, really be the advisory for those special circumstances. Excuse me. I would say that 99 out of 100 people are going to have that distribution from an IRA counted as ordinary income. So yes, it does then add to other income during the year from any other source, and could then push a person into a higher marginal tax rate.
Okay.
Obviously, the other consideration is in taking money out of a qualified retirement plan, in doing so, if a person is less than age 59 and a half, and I really don't know where the half came from, but if they're less than age 59 and a half, they also face a very strong likelihood of a 10% excise tax on the amount they distribute from that retirement plan, too. So, again, the more complicated the circumstances, the more I would recommend a person seek specialized advice from a CPA.
Okay. And maybe also it's worth, again, just reminding people, if you were thinking about, to say, setting up an IRA, that you can do, you have until April 15th, the tax deadline. So that's one of those things that actually, there's not a lot of stuff you can do to affect your last year's taxes after the end of last year. But IRA contributions is one of those things.
That is still one of those things. We'd love to have the opportunity to say that we've also saved the money somewhere and it is available to make that contribution into an IRA if we haven't already done so. I really like very simple procedures. If we put in place very simple procedures that kind of go for long-run planning, speaking of things like an IRA, this is one of the kind of things that I learned a long time ago personally, and that is we all get to a standard of living based on what you or I might refer to as our take-home pay. So, for instance, if I'm going to say to myself, well, that's that New Year's resolution, I'm going to make a contribution to my IRA, go ahead and do it. and set it up in a manner that does it every month, so that at the end of 12 months, we're not sitting there saying, oh, yeah, I was going to do that. Now, where in the heck is that money?
Yeah, okay, good thought. Here's something else by email. Person writes, my husband will be graduating from the university this spring. This means that we'll have a fairly hefty student loan that we'll be living under. On top of that, our credit has been at somewhat of a standstill while he's been in school. The only debt we have is in the form of medical bills. We have no credit cards at all, which has actually been hurting our credit, apparently, rather than helping. So how can we use the student loans in a way that will benefit our credit score quickly so that we'll be in a better position to buy a home now that we can move somewhere more permanently? And do we really have to get a credit card in order to build a better credit score?
All good questions. Again, credit scores have become the modern banking industry's way of basically allocating a scarce resource called credit. Credit scores are complicated in their construction. So when the caller or emailer is asking, should they get a credit card in order to boost their credit scores? Let's back up a moment and start with this. Upon graduation, those student loans are going to go into a payback phase. And I think the most important thing is that they consistently remain timely in those payments. If there's any optionability in those payments, in other words, when they begin after graduation, in what amount are they made, so on and so forth, those options need to be considered very carefully and elected in a way that obviously fits their income, but also shows that they're not only able to do the minimum, but they're accomplishing more than the minimum. That gets to the notion of having a credit card versus not. A credit score can be improved when a person has an active credit card, and every month they continually pay the balance in full. That takes the discipline now, of, as we were talking earlier, of realizing every time we swipe that card, we're spending somebody else's money, and they're eventually going to want that back. Mm-hmm. So those kinds of activities, showing that you can always do more than the minimum, do enhance a credit score, and a higher credit score then gets a greater opportunity, a greater potential to, again, have access to a scarce resource. That scarce resource is borrowed money or credit.
Yeah. For people who are just starting out and they're trying to build their credit and demonstrate the fact that if they borrow money, they'll pay it back, aside from having a credit card and showing that, in fact, you can do that, are there other things that people can do to establish the fact that, yes, they're credit worthy so that then, say, they want to buy a car, they want to buy a house, whatever it is, that prospective lenders would say, okay, this person is a good risk?
Sure. That's a great question. A credit score is sort of a beginning point. In discussions with a lender, there will also be the discussion about a person's financial health. So a credit score can tell a lender a lot of things, but they're superficial. Beyond the credit score, a person wants to be able to show good habits. They want to be able to show good financial condition, and those habits go hand in hand. So, for instance, if you can show that you are a regular saver and that your savings account grows over time, if you can show that you're a thrifty person and basically complete a credit application, including things like the income statement and balance sheet section of them, that shows the lender that you're a disciplined person as it comes to handling financial affairs. That's just icing on top of the credit score cake. So all of those things kind of go together in a portfolio of activity that literally give comfort to a lender that makes it more likely that a credit granting decision could come back with an answer of yes.
Yeah. What about the strategy? I guess occasionally I've heard people say, well, maybe what you might do would be to, say, go to a bank and borrow some small amount of money, whatever they'll lend you, and then, you know, make sure that in 3 months or 6 months or whatever it is, you pay it back, just to demonstrate, yes, you give me the money, yeah, you'll get your money back.
Yeah, I discourage that activity. There's there is the mechanical aspect of having that notation in the credit file of the borrower. So in other words, the credit bureaus throughout our country keep track of these types of financial transactions, and those are all inputs that generate a credit score, a FICO score. That procedure, I think, in my opinion, paying a bank interest, particularly during today's environment when the bank is paying a depositor virtually no interest, mm-hmm. is really something that's the cost is greater than the benefit. I don't think we need to go through that amount of transactional activity to try to build a credit score. I think there are better ways to demonstrate thrift. There are better ways to demonstrate a credit standing or credit worthiness.
Okay. Well, we have a caller here in McLean on line number one. Hello.
Hi. Can you hear me okay?
Yes. Go ahead.
Okay, good. I was just wondering if you can talk about, and I know I've asked this question before, but just want to understand it a little better about annuities. I ended up buying, getting some annuities years ago. So actually, they were tax deferred annuities from work, so it was easy to get the, you know, get it set up and, you know, removed and way of saving. But when I look at it in terms of what my amount I put in. And I don't know how to give you numbers because I know there are people who recognize my voice, so I hate to talk about financial stuff on, you know, more specifically. But I'm looking at the numbers, how do they pay out, pay return, like when I retire or whatever, and how long will it take before they even return my premium plus whatever else that's been accumulated? Or just talk about annuities if you can, if you don't mind, and I'll ask questions. Maybe they'll help.
Sure. A great question and a very, very large topic. So I'll be limited to talk about very, very general conditions.
Okay, sure.
Generally speaking, let's start from the beginning and call it what it is. Mm-hmm. An annuity is an insurance contract.
Okay.
At some point in time, you've put money into the contract, whether it was a one-time premium payment or perhaps even regular payments in through payroll deduction of your employer,
mm-hmm.
so on and so forth. The structure of the insurance contract allows for any investment value to build up within the contract without incurring any current year income tax obligation. So unlike putting the money into a stock mutual fund and annually having to pay any capital gains or income from dividends type of thing, the annuity contract during its funding stage is sheltering that buildup in value. The give-up is as follows. When you begin to draw money from it, that's the process called annuitization, the insurance company then begins to pay you. And part of that money is going to be classified as a return of your own contribution or capital. Part of that money is going to be classified as income, which becomes then taxable. Different annuity contracts are a lot like contracts you or I or any other two people may agree to write between each other. In other words, the features are many and varied. So as it comes to things like distribution options, annuitization options, I might say more properly, a common way would be for a life annuity. And that would literally be a calculation that would say, the insurance company would make, it would say, here's the person's balance. This is the amount of money in the account. Here's their current age. This is the life expectancy. And this is the rate of return we, the insurance company, think we can get on those funds we still hold while we're making distributions.
Mm-hmm.
We do a little arithmetic and we come down and say, okay, we think we can pay you these numbers of dollars and cents per month as long as you live.
Mm-hmm.
That really, from start to finish, is a very, very simple, rudimentary overview of what an annuity contract is in its essence.
Mm-hmm. Okay. So basically, I probably need to find somebody in the company who can talk to me because I've looked at the numbers over and over again, and I feel like the amount, you know, like they do an annual report or whatever, and it says, you'll be receiving $1,000 for the rest of your life. So as it stays in the system and there is a floor of a 4% interest building into it, no matter what. Anyway, so this is kind of funny. And then there is also a flexible where I could put it in different accounts, you know, like into mutual funds and stuff. Well, I made some bad decisions, unfortunately, not knowing what I was doing. And my cash value is very little. My death value is fantastic. I should put NPR on the list or something like that, you know. If I die, somebody will get most of the money. If I annuitize, my problem is when I look at it, if I annuitize as they're telling me they'll give me back, I'd have to live for another 100 years for them to give me principal back. Am I being unrealistic or am I not reading it right?
No, I think you're being probably very realistic. As a matter of fact, the elements that you've just mentioned kind of lead me to believe that we could do an entire show or two or three just on annuities. Some of the features, some of the details that you were just going through. I mean, these are really intricate contracts. And just to speak to one or two of them very briefly, the mention you made about the death benefit being large, but the cash value being small. Again, going back to my original mention, this is a contract with an insurance company, and it really is within the realm of a life insurance contract.
Right, okay.
So the gamble that any insurance company makes on a life insurance contract is that you're going to live long and not short. The payment of premiums then over time build up cash value. But what we have to remember is the essence of that is a pure death benefit that's built on a pure cost of insurance. So, yes, the death benefit is big because that reflects the fact that the bet made is that you're going to live a long time and pay a lot of money into the product and not, how should we say, have an untimely early demise.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
That difference between the cash value and the death benefit is really based on that actuarial assumption and the fact that each year that cash value is only going to grow based on a rate of return of investment minus the pure cost of insurance. You see, there is a cost to guarantee a payment upon a person's demise.
Right, right. Yeah, I understand. Yeah, that's a little part I finally have gotten that part, that everything costs something. A couple things. One is I think for all the programming people behind here at WILL to listen to this, maybe there is worth doing this program because there are still annuities out there. And unfortunately, and I was much, much younger when I got this, I didn't understand what I was getting into. And it was an easy thing. It was saving me taxes, you know, at the time. And, of course, it was ridiculous because I made much less money, but I found that as a form of savings. And what I feel like is I'm tied into it. If I annuitize, I will not even get my principal back. If I, you know, live to be, you know, 50 more years, which I don't think I would. And then, so either I give it as a death benefit to somebody, or, you know, it's just like my options are really poor in terms of actually using as retirement money. And that's how I thought I understood that it's what I was doing. And I'm not adding any more to it because I left that job a long time ago. So whatever there is, because then I tried to maximize. Anyway, so basically what you're saying is because I understand there really are a lot of different contracts. So at this point in time, I'm pretty much stuck making a decision whether I leave it as a death benefit for someone, leave it as a gift for someone, or annuitize and hope that I get something back from it.
Right. Let me try to summarize all of what we've just discussed. One of the ways that I would say your circumstance might be best approached, and this isn't going to change what you have.
Okay.
But to get some qualified advice on it, I would seek out, and the best way to find a person is word of mouth, through your friends, through your family. Find the name of a person who's a trusted advisor who's literally going to look at the contract, look at your circumstance, and then at least allow you to choose the best of the options available to you.
Mm-hmm. So going back to the company, asking for advice is not necessarily a good idea.
Well, there's nothing wrong with an independent assessment, and that's where I would say friends, family. However, find a good qualified independent financial person. Doesn't have to be a CPA, doesn't have to be a commission salesperson. Someone that you, how should we say, discover through word of mouth. It's the best form of advertising. Mm-hmm. That's qualified to take a look at it and at least assess what would be the best election for you and your circumstances.
So then I would have to make sure that whoever this person is actually knows a lot about annuities.
Well, I generally go to a doctor if it's a medical issue.
Right. No. Yeah, well, I understand. So, but what I'm saying is I need to go to a GI specialist versus a cardiologist then.
Well, I'd say you'd need to go to someone that's familiar with insurance products, particularly annuities, as opposed to somebody who's familiar with tax returns.
Okay. All right. I'm just clarifying. Okay. That's what I'm thinking. Okay. Great. Well, thank you very much for your time.
Well, thank you. Let's just go on here. We have somebody also rating here in Champaign County. This is line number 2. Hello.
Good morning, gentlemen.
Mm-hmm.
A couple of questions, Kevin. Actually, I have 3. One's regarding a bond fund. I'm interested in placing savings in a tax-exempt bond fund. And I want to increase my allocations in bond funds and less in my taxable stock fund accounts. And I'm considering investing in Vanguard's Intermediate Term Tax Exempt Fund. Now, when I look at the annual report for that, for their Vanguard funds, it's showing the average effective maturity for that fund is 5.7 years, average duration is 5.4 years. And then it's got a spread of the total returns from 1, 5, 10 years. And at 1 year, it's 3.35%, 5 years, 4.5%, et cetera. So I'd like your opinion, any comments or suggestion on going into the Vanguard Intermediate Term Tax Exempt Fund.
Sure. Just a general caution. Interest rates are at or near all-time lows.
Yeah.
One of the numbers that you just cited off of that particular fund was duration. Duration is a nice little indicator. It allows us to give a pretty close, but I would say inexact approximation of the value change in a bond or a portfolio of bonds when interest rates in the marketplace change. So we both probably know that when interest rates rise, the value of bonds declines. So here's your risk. You're thinking about putting money into an investment portfolio that we know will decline in value when, not if, but when interest rates rise. Now, that in its statement is not meant to say do not put money into it, but it's meant to be a great caution to be putting a lot of money, or how should we say, a normal allocation into a fixed income fund at this particular time. That 5.4 number as a kind of a off back of the envelope approach could be used as follows. If interest rates on these type of bonds rises such that their yield a year from now is 1 percentage point higher, the value of that fund is probably going to be roughly 5.4% lower. So your dollar on the account statement will look to have a value of 5.5 cents less. So if you don't mind seeing that dollar now being reflected at value of 94.6 cents, then, you know, or 94.6 cents on the dollar, that's something that you're just going to roll with the punches.
Okay. And, yeah, so that leads me to the next question. It's kind of related to this first one. So I have a loan on some farmland we purchased, and the interest rate on that farmland loan is presently 4.9%, and it's going to be repriced next month. It'll be going down to 3.7%. So we're considering making additional payments on that loan, as opposed to, and paying off early, as opposed to making investments in a bond fund. And I just wondered if you concur with that.
You said the interest rate's going to reset next month. Is there an opportunity for you to secure a fixed rate loan on the farmland?
Evidently, it's set up to be repriced every so often. In fact,
okay, well, that's the current loan, but have you talked with lenders to see if you can get any fixed-rate financing?
Okay. No, I haven't.
That would be my first goal, and if I could secure a fixed-rate financing on it, obviously we need to look at the income. We need to look at, what the end-of-season results are. If that farm ground with that loan on it is positive cash flow, if you don't have to feed it with that loan in place, my objective would be to get a fixed rate loan, number one. Number two, to have it locked, to have it as long a term as I could find. So if I could find a lender that would put a 10, 15, 20, heck, even 30-year loan on it at a fixed rate, I'd do that in a heartbeat, and I'd pay no more than the minimum amount that I need to pay.
Okay, okay, okay. So the question is that I'm trying to get answered in my mind is it more advantageous to pay off a loan early, and in this case, such as farmland, that interest can be deducted from the farm income. Is that a smart thing to do?
Well, again, that kind of gets to the whole picture of the farm with the debt in place, the income it generates, and what I mentioned about, you know, is it positive cash flow? As you pointed out, the interest expense is a deduction against the farm income, so you're paying a tax-subsidized rate of interest. As we've mentioned earlier, we're at or near all-time low in interest rates. It seems clear to me that when policies in place in our government make it such that they're darn near giving money away for free, I want to grab all I can. I want to grab it for as long as I can, as long as they can't change the terms of the deal. Because I'm not predicting that a week from now, a month from now, a year from now, or even 2 years from now, interest rates will be substantially higher. But I will say this: in your lifetime, you will experience interest rates much higher than they are at present.
Oh, I'm sure. Yeah.
And why not lock in low rates on debt right now? For goodness sakes, our government is screaming everything from the top of their lungs possible about trying to make people in debt solvent. So, I'm not trying to be catty here or anything, but it's a very perverted marketplace, and I think taking advantage of it does go against my natural grain of wanting to pay debt off sooner rather than later, or not even want to incur debt. But honest to goodness, I've considered taking out a mortgage myself. I don't have a mortgage now, but I'm thinking about taking one out.
So you're actually, I think what you're saying is, don't attempt to pay it off early.
It goes against my natural grain, but that's exactly what I'm saying.
Okay.
As long as you can lock in the interest rate. If you're exposed to a floating rate of interest on the debt, then it's a different story, because I don't want that exposure. I want just the opposite. I want to take advantage of that eventual rise in interest rates.
And I'm going to jump in here. I hope the caller will forgive me. I got somebody else here who's waiting, and we need to just take a real short break here, and then we'll have some more focus. This is the day of the month where we take questions on money management. Kevin Waspy is our guest. He's a lecturer in finance at the College of Business at the U of I. We'll continue in just a moment. This is Focus.
Have you turned to WILL to help keep you informed of current events in our country and around the world? You might turn to WILL to get up-to-date information about financial and agricultural markets. These are just a few examples of the range of programming services found on WILL. Please consider making an additional pledge of support today. Your gift will help us continue to offer comprehensive news and information programs. Make your contribution online at willpledge.org.
WILL programs are made possible by Strawberry Fields Natural Food Store, offering more than 3,000 certified organic products, freshly baked breads, a coffee bar and bulk foods department, and an in-store nutritionist to answer questions about healthy eating. Strawberry Fields on Springfield Avenue in Urbana.
This is Focus, our morning talk show. I'm David Inge. Glad to have you with us. We're here Monday through Friday from 10 until noon with 10 different topics every week. In the second hour today, Dennis Barron will be here. He's professor of English at University of Illinois, and occasionally as on the show we hear talk about words, language, grammar. It's always a lot of fun when he is on. If people want to call and ask questions about usage, that's fine. You want to complain about misuse of the language, we cannot promise vindication, but we'll give you a chance to air your grievances. That's hour two. On Monday, actually, we have another financial planning topic for you on Monday, but it's fairly specific, and we'll be talking on Monday at 10 about estate planning. John Elder will be our guest. He's a local attorney, an estate planner, a man who has been in that business for a long time, very experienced, very nice fellow, knows an awful lot. So if you have questions about things like wills and trusts that area, he is an expert. You can call in and take that opportunity to ask questions on Monday. Then also Monday at 11, it's our program on women's health, and Dr. Suzanne Troopen will be here. She is an obstetrician and a gynecologist, and she's on the program every other month. That's always a Monday. Questions are welcome here on this program. You can check the schedule, by the way, by going to our website, which is will.illinois.edu. The guest this morning in this hour is Kevin Waspy. He's lecturer of finance in the College of Business at the U of I, and this is our monthly show on money management. Questions are welcome. 333-9455, toll free, 800-222-9455. Email will-talk@illinois.edu. And here is another caller in Morton Grove, line number 4. Hello.
Yes, hi.
Hi.
I wanted to ask a question. I've had a long-term annuity with Fidelity, and it was which allowed me to make various investments about 3 years ago. I moved that over to Metropolitan for a fixed program that they had for 3 years at 4%. Perhaps not the best arrangement, but it was okay. That's coming to an end, and I've talked to the Fidelity people about avoiding taxes, and the information I got is that I could bring it over to Fidelity, because they were the one who got me the Metropolitan program, and bring it over to Fidelity and maybe use it as a variable annuity. I wondered, my goal would be to avoid paying any taxes on any growth in this money over the years, and I was wondering if you had any thoughts beyond moving it over to a variable annuity and taking advantage of their broad range of mutual funds that they offer, again, avoid the any taxes on the growth. So I'm listening to whatever you tell me.
Well, again, annuities are complicated. You've brought up some really interesting points. Let me try to take them succinctly as I can. Fixed versus variable, as you've pointed out, a variable annuity allows a menu of investment selections. So they appear to be things like mutual funds. Technically, they're not mutual funds, but in essence, they act exactly like your ability to choose across a palette of mutual funds.
Uh-huh.
So we're now moving away from a fixed annuity. The fixed annuity is literally a contract rate of growth, or rate of return, if you want to call it that, that the insurance company promises for a certain period of time. So let's reflect on what you have now is a 4% fixed, and it was a 3-year contract term.
And
in hindsight, that was a beautiful decision.
Well, thank you. As you might have guessed, that's no longer available to me at the...
Right. So what is the contract rate for, say, another three-year term? Have you shopped that? Have you asked?
Somewhere around 1.5%.
Okay. Well, that's pretty unattractive, isn't it?
Yes.
As a reference point or just a kind of a comparable, I can tell you the yield on a two-year Treasury note is 22 basis points.
Mm-hmm.
That's 0.022%.
Pretty low.
I can tell you that the yield on a 10-year Treasury note is 1.97%. So, again, we're in an environment where interest rates are laughably low.
Yes.
Okay. Now, let me caution you about moving annuities. Insurance companies are very adept at transferring an annuity from one company to another without incurring a tax obligation.
Yes.
That's an easy thing to do. But what I would caution you with is this. An insurance contract, in its basic essence, has upfront costs in it, and I've yet to see one that doesn't have any upfront costs. In other words, you might be finding yourself moving backward from a point of view of having incurred upfront fees, let's call them commissions to an agent or upfront setup fees to a company or a combination of both, by moving from one company's annuity to another company's annuity. That's, you know, that you just don't want to pay too many of those. As a matter of fact, your goal ought to be to pay as few as you can.
Yes.
So moving from company to company, you need to look at any ramification that is to literally set you back by virtue of setting up a new contract at a new company. Last thing real quickly about investment selection. Just because the contract offers you a palette of what appear to be an unlimited number of options to invest in doesn't necessarily mean that you should be in any of them. It certainly doesn't mean that you should be in a lot of them. Generally, I like the kind of keep it simple, stupid approach.
Right.
So if the existing company offers you a handful of selections in a variable annuity through them, and you're not incurring any kind of setup costs or commissions in moving back to Fidelity, then that's something that you got to kind of weigh in the mix here.
Okay. So maybe speak to them about if there is and what it would cost if they offer variables as well as fixed. And
what those variable options have done, what their cost is, in other words, their expense ratios. Those are the kind of things that we look behind the scenes at, whether we look directly at a specific mutual fund or an insurance product called an annuity contract that offers these variable investment accounts within it. So we want to look under the hood, so to speak, and we want to see what we're buying, what it's done historically, and what we're paying when we're in it.
Okay. I hear you loud and clear. On this subject, I have no longer questions, but I frankly do have another question, but I don't want to take advantage. Do you have time for another one?
Well, our last caller before you wanted to ask another question, so I'm sure we can get them. How is it a complicated question that you wanted to ask?
Well, I'm just trying to foresee in a low interest environment, which we have right now, especially on mortgages, which was the previous subject.
Mm-hmm.
At some point when things start to ratchet up and mortgages will cost more and more, usually the banks were able to ride with this because they had an opportunity. People were moving, and the next person moves, they would get a higher interest rate and kind of things. There were ways to cope with the fact that they may have only low-interest mortgages at this point. Nobody's moving. And are they going to be able to cope with that as the higher mortgage rates go up? And I'll shut up after that. I'm just, it's sort of a theoretical thing. I don't know.
Yeah.
Well, that's a great question. It's one of my favorites. I mean, I'd love to sit down over an adult beverage with you and discuss what's going on in the banking industry, what's going on in the global economy, the macro economy of the United States, interest rate policy, the future of banking, what the profit outlooks are for firms in that industry, the general impact it will have to things like personal income and job security. But I don't think we have the time.
Well, I tell you what, I want to thank the caller, and I do wanted to. I think we had an earlier caller, and I did want to give him a chance. He I think it was one other thing he wanted to ask. We can do that, and if somebody dials up real quick, we can get in another call. We'll see. We'll go back to Champaign County, I believe. Here, line number one. Hello.
Thanks again for taking my call again.
Yeah, sure. No, that's fine.
Okay, my third question was regarding this farm loan I mentioned, farmland. And I mentioned it's going to be repriced first the next month. And I will see if a fixed rate is available. But it's currently interest is 4.9%. And I was told there are three options for repricing. One is a three-year duration loan at 3.25% interest. And we figured that annual savings would be $1,500 and therefore $4,500 savings for 3 years. Then there's a five-year repricing at a five-year duration at 3.7%, and the savings is $1,100 and $5,500 for the 5 years. And then the last option was a seven-year rate at 4.1%, annual savings of $745 a year for a total of $5,200 over that seven-year period. So we were considering choosing that option, too, because it appear to be greater savings over the five-year period of $1,000 than the others. Just wonder if you concur with that. If I can't go to a fixed-rate financing.
I don't think there's any problem at all with your arithmetic. I'll point out a couple of things.
Please.
The $5,000 or rough figure of $5,000 in savings. I mean, we're talking about an annual IRA contribution. So my guess is that's not going to make a difference in your standard of living.
Mm-hmm.
I think your objective ought to be, let me put it generically. I think the objective of any person carrying debt today ought to be the following. Let's make it a fixed rate of interest, and let's try to lock that fixed rate of interest in for as long as possible. So I don't really want you to answer this question, but I'll ask it in a hypothetical. Are you talking with one lender that happens to be a bank? And if the answer is yes, have you investigated other loan potentials, say, through the Federal Farm Credit Systems, who are generally specialists in long-term fixed rate financing on agricultural enterprises? So explore your options before you make your decision.
So that's an option to move the loan someplace else?
Amen.
Oh.
Last I checked, we still live in the United States.
Oh, I thought I had to complete the duration of the loan with them.
Well, when we talk about refinancing a mortgage, we're literally talking about borrowing money from somebody else to pay off an existing loan. So absolutely. You literally need to look at your refinancing options, and that can mean with anybody who makes loans in this area to the best advantage of you and pay off your existing borrower or lender.
Well, thank you. I didn't realize I had that option.
Gotta love America.
Okay.
Well, thank you for the call. We got a couple of minutes left here. I guess I would just again underline, as has come up in the conversation here, that if you can qualify for financing and if you're in the market for a home, not such a bad time. In fact, according to the Mortgage Bankers Association last week, rates for both 30-year and 15-year fixed loans fell to new record lows. So and there's been a big bump up in applications, although also according to this article that I have in front of me, most of those people actually are refinancing.
Most of those loan activities over the past 3 years have been refinances. New house purchases Even this morning's report, sales of existing houses, despite the fact that they were up 5% in the past month, still puts them near multi-year lows. I'm talking the past 30-year lows. The bottom line is this. I made mention earlier that I'm personally thinking about doing something that totally goes against my grain, and that is borrowing money. I don't have a mortgage now, thank goodness. But when I see the kinds of rates that are available for 30 years and those interest rates are fixed at those levels, even if I take that money and do nothing but put it in a savings account, I am beginning to be tempted to do so. That's how dramatically low and dramatically advantageous these interest rates are for these periods of time. A 30-year fixed rate loan at less than 4%. It might be a once in a lifetime. I'll put it this way. I hope it's a once in a lifetime because it's totally nuts.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And it was one thing that I also think is totally nuts. I read this the other day that somebody has apparently predicted that either late this year or early next year, the price of gold will go over $2,000 an ounce.
David, I can tell you this. If I do something silly enough, like put a mortgage on my house, I will not use the money to buy gold.
Okay, good. I'm glad to hear about it because it hasn't, you know, within recent memory, it hasn't been all that long that it was under $300. And it would make me very, very, given that something like that can exhibit that kind of volatility. If it's one of those things where if everybody's running to do it, I want to be running in the opposite direction. That's my philosophy.
That's generally not a bad thing. I'm not saying anything about the price of gold, which is $1,661.97 an ounce right now. Owning gold or not owning gold doesn't enter into the statement I just made. The statement I just made means I won't borrow money against my house and put it into something that volatile.
Yeah, right.
So, yeah, it's a weird world we live in.
Kevin Wasby, he's a lecturer of finance in the College of Business at the University of Illinois. Occasionally he's here on this program, and we do it every month to talk about money management. Thanks very much.
Thank you, David. Always fun to be here.